From WHQR Public Radio in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. 13 Reasons Why, first a book, then a Netflix series, tells the story of Hannah Baker, a high school student who dies by suicide. But before she carries it out, she creates old school cassette tapes, each one telling the story of a particular person who hurt her, which add up to the 13 reasons why she says she decided to die. There are various injuries, small and large, including a rape by a classmate. In April of this year, the National Association of School Psychologists, NASP, put out a statement warning about the risk factors of such a show. The NASP says research shows exposure to another person's suicide or to graphic or sensationalized accounts of death can be one of the many risk factors that young people struggling with mental health conditions cite as a reason they contemplate or attempt suicide. The statistics on teen suicide are alarming. Suicide is the leading cause of death, the second leading cause of death in people under 34 in North Carolina. That's up compared to 20 years ago when suicide sat at number 3 under unintentional injury and homicide. New data from the National Institute for Health Statistics shows suicide among girls between the ages of 15 and 19 hit a 40-year high in 2015, the last year for which data is available, and CNN reports the suicide rate for those girls doubled between 2007 and 2015. For male teenagers, the suicide rate increased by 31%. Today, we'll find out why 75% of kids who are suicidal never receive any mental health care, and why young people in rural areas are twice as likely to die by suicide as kids in urban or suburban areas. We'll also explore how this community is dealing with the series and why some local teachers have decided to show it in class. With us today, two mental health professionals. Dr. Kate Nooner is an associate professor of psychology at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. She is also a practicing clinical psychologist specializing in child and adolescent mental health at the Chrysalis Center for Counseling in Wilmington. Dr. Kate Nooner, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Kristen Williams is a licensed clinical social worker. She is also the school-based services program director for Coastal Horizons in Wilmington. Kristen Williams, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
And we're inviting you to join the conversation. Have you watched 13 Reasons Why? Did you learn anything? If so, what? Do you think it's a dangerous siren call to suicide for those who might be vulnerable? Call us on this Thursday at 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org. And if you would like to remain anonymous, make sure you make that clear in the top of your email. Kate Nooner, do we know more about the risk factors for suicide and prevention than we did 20 years ago?
Absolutely. There's a large body of research that's been conducted on some of the factors that contribute to teen suicide, including things like bullying, increased substance use, specifically alcohol use, and having things happen like sexual assault or rape. But we also know a lot more about the treatments, including cognitive behavioral therapy, which can help in terms of modifying thoughts and behaviors that might be contributing to you feeling suicidal, and things like dialectic behavior therapy that was specifically developed for suicidal and at-risk individuals.
So if that's the case, why then is the suicide rate up instead of down?
That's a very good question, and I think there's a bunch of reasons for that. You know, one has to do with the simple fact that, 75% of the youth who are suicidal never make it in for any mental health care. So they are never getting the good treatments that are out there. Those who do, do extremely well. But those who don't, do not, who are out there, are at very high rates of committing suicide within a year or certainly in their young adulthood.
So then it would be logical to say the risk factors are increasing. As you said, bullying, sexual assault, use of alcohol.
Kristen Williams, are we seeing a spike in those things in kids these days?
I think we are, and I think we're also seeing a spike in adverse childhood experiences that are leading to traumatic histories for some of our students and some of our teens, and that certainly plays a role in someone's decision to commit suicide or not.
One of the takeaways from 13 Reasons Why is that we should all be nicer to people because we don't understand how even a small slight or insult or injury can impact another person, which is really a lovely idea. It is. But is that really why someone, I mean, is this one of the problems with the series, Kate Nooner, that it's these 13 people hurt me, so it's your fault?
Certainly the series is a fantasy of suicide. It is never simple. And some of the reasons why teens become suicide is because they even have difficulty understanding what their emotions are. Teens' frontal lobes are not fully developed yet. And so they may feel like, I can't even label or describe what I'm feeling, but it's so bad. And so they turn to suicide instead. I think another point is that, you know, we should be nicer to people, of course, but also we should get off our devices more. You know, the 24/7 of, you know, when if you're bullied at school, that it never stops, and that teens have it all the time. Every patient that I see, I want to like get down on my hands and knees and say to the parents, take their devices at night, put them up. It's only no good that's happening. And I think that is something that we're seeing that's amplifying a lot of the problems for teens.
Tell us why. Tell us specifically why. I want to get up and do a happy dance to hear you say that, but I'm not. I want you to unpack that a little bit. What's so dangerous about a teenager lying in bed at night while everybody else has gone to bed,
hanging
out?
A lot of things, and Kristen, please chime in too. I think one of the big problems with that is that they're, you know, ruminating. They're going over and over and over things in their mind. And so, as I already mentioned, teens are not able to regulate their emotions like adults. They're not able to make higher level decisions like adults. And things that happen briefly feel like they're forever. And looking at it at your on your phone at night over and over and over make it more. It also, though, I've had patients who've become victims that way, where they get a text or a message from someone at night and they make a poor choice as a result of that. And if they did not have their phone in front of them, then that would not be something that was happening.
What specifically, what kind of poor choice, what kind of text? What do you mean?
Often texts from, you know, a girl would get a text from a boy that would say, come and meet me here. Let's go and do this. It can result in substance use. It often results in unwanted sexual activity. It can result in sexual assault. And that can lead to guilt and shame and, you know, feeling suicidal ultimately.
Kristen Williams, we raised bullying as one of the issues that contributes to a kid's likelihood to take his or her own life. How does bullying play out today versus how it did maybe 20 years ago? What's different about it that maybe parents don't fully understand?
Sure. So one of the things that we know is a protective factor for teenagers is having that social connection with their peers, with their families, and for those to be healthy relationships. And to the point of having technology so involved in their lives, it takes away that personal interaction. Things are not shared in the same way. Emotions are not shared in the same way. And so I think bullying now also comes in, and we see it in different forms than we have in the past. And so to Kate's point of now they're receiving texts and they're kind of ruminating on those and they're sitting with that and don't have an outlet for sharing of those emotions and feelings. I think also we're seeing bullying in, although on social media can be almost hidden from some of the adults in their life that don't necessarily have the same access to the social media that their kids are using or their students are using. And so it's almost becoming I would say, not so much in the forefront for the people who are working, the adults who are working with some of these students.
So how does it make it worse when a dialogue between kids that maybe is harmful to one or both of the people involved, keeping that away from adults, how does that make that dialogue more powerful? I mean, how does keeping it shrouded in just the world of the adolescent escalate it? Kate Nooner.
I mean, it's kind of a classic case of the blind leading the blind, and that you have, you know, people who don't have very good judgment yet interacting with other people who are also pretty emotionally reactive and don't have that good judgment yet. And even other teens with the best of intentions do not have the tools that an adult would have, and certainly don't have any of the tools that a mental health professional would have to look at something and help set things right.
Kristen Williams, has there been a time, and we're going to go to break in just a minute, so we may have to continue this story when we come back, but has there been a time that you've known about an at-risk child who has then gone on and successfully died by suicide? That's a strange way to put it, but who you haven't been able to help?
Absolutely, and I think we hear about those secondhand, and that's always a tragedy that we hear about it after. And for me, as a mental health professional, as a licensed social worker, it's really hard because I know that the interventions are out there, and it's a matter of getting those kids connected at the right time.
And I want to find out more about a specific case so that we can just use that maybe as a study in what went wrong, what we know. You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. It's a conversation about teen suicide, why the rate seems to be going up, what parents, friends, communities can do to help. Do you know someone who struggled with depression and thoughts of suicide? Do you have questions for our mental health professionals today? You can call us during this live Thursday show at 910-343-1138 or email your question to coastline@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. We're talking today about risk factors for teen suicide, why the rate is going up, and whether the Netflix series 13 Reasons Why is a dangerous glamorization of suicide or a good launching pad for a hard conversation. With us today is Kristen Williams. She's a licensed clinical social worker and school-based services program director for Coastal Horizons. Dr. Kate Nooner is an associate professor of psychology at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. She's also a practicing clinical psychologist specializing in child and adolescent mental health at the Chrysalis Center for Counseling in Wilmington. You can ask your own question on this Thursday by calling us at 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org. And if you'd like to remain anonymous, make sure you make that clear at the top of the email. Before we went to break, Kristen Williams, you were saying you certainly have seen cases where you've known about an adolescent who's been at risk, and then you found out secondhand that they've actually carried out a suicide. Can you talk about a specific case, of course, without identifying the person or the family or anything, but a specific case in which you can look at that now and say, I see clearly what went wrong there?
I think when you have two different kinds of cases there. You have cases for teens who never accessed treatment, and then cases for teens who did. And we know that for teens who are feeling suicidal and having suicidal thoughts that access treatment, the rate at which they get better obviously increases. And then there are times when, like we had talked about earlier in the show, that kids don't access treatment, that it's that they do end up committing suicide. And in those cases, I think those are the hardest because it's easy for us to all look back and say, if we had read the warning signs. And so for me, I think that's part of that conversation is knowing what those warning signs are so that way we can properly get people attached to treatment if they need it.
Okay, so the warning signs. We're going to get a list of those in a second. But first, Don writes, have there been any findings of the impact that socioeconomic factors have on teen suicide? Is it more likely among rich kids, poor kids? Kate Nooner.
Suicide cuts across all socioeconomic status. Rates are alarming for wealthier kids and for kids who are more economically disadvantaged. However, children from more economically disadvantaged backgrounds are less likely to get into care because they don't have access and are also less likely to get the evidence-based care when they get into care. So they do have higher rates for some of those reasons.
And when you talk about evidence-based care, you're talking about?
I'm talking about therapy such as cognitive behavioral therapy or dialectic behavioral therapy that has been studied and is known to clinically reduce rates of suicide and related problems.
We're talking about teen suicide today. Our experts are Kate Nooner. She's an associate professor of psychology at UNCW and a practicing clinical psychologist at the Chrysalis Center in Wilmington. We also have Kristen Williams with us. She is a licensed clinical social worker and school-based services program director for Coastal Horizons in Wilmington. You can call us on this Thursday at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. That's .org, not .com. Jason from Leland, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Hey, good afternoon, Rachel. Thank you for having me on.
Absolutely.
Ms. Williams, Ms. Nooner, welcome. A long-time listener to the show, first time I've called in. This topic hits particularly close to home for myself and my family. My younger brother took his own life 10 weeks ago, and we had a bit of a different relationship, if you will. He was 20 years my junior. He was 17, and he came to live with my wife and I about 2.5 years ago. And we took him from an environment where he had been pretty badly abused and went through some pretty intensive therapy as a young man. And when he came to live with us, we all collectively went to therapy just to make sure that the transition was, you know, going well and he was settling in and we were settling in collectively. And for a few years, everything seemed to be going fine. Until, like I said, 10 weeks ago, he took his own life. And there's two things that your panelists spoke about earlier that really made me think about some thoughts. One was the regulation of emotions. On the outside, Hunter was the most outgoing, loving, nicest kid you'd ever meet, but on the inside, he was struggling with those feelings and the issues that surrounded the assault. So we would always say, on the outside of the house, he's one young man, and on the inside of the house, he's another. Because that was his safe space and where he could allow himself to feel that emotion. And the other one that really hit home to me was in the last few months leading up to him taking his own life, we really started to notice a change. And we just attributed it to him being a 17-year-old young man and going through life changes. And, you know, he was getting ready to go into the military and he was, he was growing up, had his first girlfriend and those things. And there was certain times where we sat him down and said, you know, we noticed some changes. Do you feel like you need to go back to therapy or should we all go back to therapy? And he pretty much flatly refused. So my point there is if any of your listeners have a child, that this is even a thought that they may hurt themselves, I would offer to them, maybe take it into their own hands and take action and not just let the child perhaps dictate that they're okay. As a family that survived this, we can look back and we can say, what could we have done differently and this and that, and we'll probably do that forever. But that's one of the big ones that really sticks with us. So,
Jason, we're all so sorry for your loss. Dr. Nooner, what would you say to Jason? Because one of the things, I'm not surprised to hear him say, we're all looking back, and probably for the rest of our lives, we'll look back on what should we have done differently.
Well, first of all, Jason, thank you so much for calling in. You're doing a great service to the many parents who are listening right now who are in the situation that you are in. and still have a chance to avoid the devastating outcome. I am so sorry for your loss and that Hunter's Light is no longer with us. You know, that's not something, like you said, that you ever recover from. But what we can do in terms of helping others is really the point that you said at the end. Teens that I see, almost none of them want to be there. However, all of them, once they kind of get settled in and get going, share important things and do important work that helps make changes in their lives. And, you know, there's hills and valleys in that, but a lot of times, you know, they leave and just like what Hunter said to you, I'm fine, I'm good, no, I don't need this, it's stupid. And I always say to parents, please just keep bringing them. And because over time, it makes a difference. But just like you said with his history of trauma that went on, and then he came to you, and it was a many-year process. Climbing out of things like that are a many-year process and often require teens to be in treatment for a long time. So really thank you for calling and doing that service to other families. It's a tremendous help.
Thank you for your kind words, and we just hope that, you know, we want to turn this into as positive of an experience as we can and make sure that, you know, no other family has to experience this. So thank you very much for your time, and everybody have a great day.
Thank you so much, Jason. Thanks for that call. We're talking with Dr. Kate Nooner. She's an associate professor of psychology at UNCW and a practicing clinical psychologist specializing in child and adolescent mental health at the Chrysalis Center in Wilmington. And Kristen Williams, licensed clinical social worker and school-based services program director for Coastal Horizons in Wilmington. It's a conversation about teen suicide, 13 Reasons Why, the Netflix series. Is it a good conversation launcher, or is it somehow glamorizing a terrible decision? You can ask your own question of our experts on this Thursday by calling us at 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org. I want to talk for a minute about the stigma that surrounds seeking help for mental health issues or depression or feelings a kid just doesn't understand. I've heard that the stigma around it isn't just about mental health. There's something about attention seeking and other kids maybe bullying kids or criticizing their peers for seeking attention. One person has talked with me about self-harm and how if a person who cuts themselves does it in a place that's visible, they get accused of seeking attention. Now, as an adult, my answer to that is, well, for goodness sake, they need attention. But that's not the way it works in the world of teenagers. What is that stigma around attention seeking? Kristen Williams.
I think part of it is, and we keep having that conversation over and over again, is that their teens are in an identity forming phase of their life. And so when we talk about suicide and we talk about self-harm and attention seeking, they're really trying to find ways to cope with the emotions and to deal with the emotions that they're feeling that they don't yet have the tools for. Therapy is a great way to learn those tools, but I think also amongst your peer groups, there's this sometimes sense of I need to be strong, I need to, not everyone understands what I'm going through. We start to see kids who are feeling hopeless, and so seeking treatment doesn't even seem like an option for them.
Kate Nooner.
I think also, you know, for teens, one thing that they worry about, and rightly so, is that they're walking such a fine line. It's, you know, like be low-key but not too low-key. You know, wear the right thing and say the right thing and do the right thing but not too much. You know, stand out but not too much. And so, you know, with self-injury, I think that can that crosses that line. When, you know, as you correctly said, Rachel, from, you know, certainly a mental health perspective and a parent's perspective, it's, my goodness, you certainly need help if you're doing that. But from a teen's perspective, it just can easily move to bullying of, oh, you've gone too far. Now that's not cool anymore. You shouldn't be doing that, rather than seeing it as a need for help. But again, it's the blind leading the blind. You know, teens are not adequately able to help other teens and often do much more harm than good.
So this calls to mind an image of all these kids competing for attention from the adult world, competing for approval. And if they can't get it in a positive way by, say, getting straight A's or, you know, being a superstar in sports, then other kids look down on them for getting it by saying, I hate myself. I need help. Please help me. It's just such a strange catch-22. What's a kid to do? I mean, what would you tell me? I'm 15. And I'm cutting myself, and I'm doing it in a place that no one can see it, so no one knows. Right. And I don't want to go to a counselor because then my friends are going to say, she's just looking for attention. What do I do?
Go to a trusted adult immediately and go to a counselor. And hopefully that parent will take them to a counselor. And, you know, counseling is confidential, so nobody needs to know about it. It's not something that you need to share, and it will get better. The pain that you're feeling today, is not going to be necessarily what you're feeling tomorrow, and there are many different tools that you can use to alleviate that pain without self-harming.
Kristen Williams, if I am a student in the New Hanover County Public School System, what specifically can I do? Who can I go to in a way that will be confidential, that my friends won't find out?
And like Kate had said, I think the first step is to find that trusted adult. So even if it's not a mental health professional, that trusted adult that you can talk to and you can share some of your feelings with and let them kind of help guide you to that. But in New Hanover County specifically, through Coastal Horizons, we have wellness centers on each of our four college campuses where students can access both primary and mental health care right on campus. And so we're really working towards having students kind of help each other get through that stigma of, now that this is on campus and an opportunity for us to access care, how are we as a student body and as a community really supporting that, as opposed to putting students down for wanting to access? And then on top of that, we also have mental health professionals in all of our schools through various organizations. And then there's just lots of community resources that students can access.
And I don't mean to keep reverting to the 15-year-old, but we keep saying trusted adult, and that sounds really good. But what if I am an okay student, or what if I'm having so much trouble that I'm too ashamed to go to my parents who have no idea this is going on, or to go to any adult that maybe thinks I'm smart or talented or I'm doing some things right, and if I tell them that I'm harming myself or that I'm really struggling with thoughts of suicide, their whole opinion of me is going to change. What do I do? Kate Nooner.
I think, from a teen, it's hard to understand that we are all imperfect and we have all had highs and lows in our lives. And, you know, everyone has something in the closet. As a teen coming up, you kind of think, I'm the only one, when you never are. And so not to, you know, keep making the same point, but it's the right point, is you know, go to a trusted adult. You will be surprised, and, you know, you will get the help you need.
So let's talk about parents for a second, because one of the recurring patterns in 13 Reasons Why is the parents who care, they see something is going wrong with their kids, and they keep trying to open a conversation. They keep saying, hey, can we talk? But they're trying to respect the fact that the kid is growing into an adult. So trying to respect boundaries at the same time they're trying to say, hey, I am here. And the conversation always fails. There's never a good conversation in this show. Is that just the way it is with parents, Kristen Williams? Or is there a way that parents can open a productive conversation where the kid will say, actually, Mom, I need to tell you this?
And I think that's a very fine line that parents toe between the, I want to respect privacy so that way we have a strong relationship and they feel like I am attuned to their needs and adhering to their privacy. But at the same time, we want to ensure that our kids are safe and that they're well taken care of. And I think above anything else, being able to have direct conversations and ask direct questions, but then also to be able to listen without judgment, which is difficult. I can understand that. But I think the more conversations parents are having with their kids, and it's the less lecture and the more listening that's happening, I think kids will start to, and teens start to open up a little bit about feeling like their boundaries are being respected, because they're not being told what to do necessarily, but they are, their feelings and their emotions and their thoughts are being heard. And I think that's often one of the things that people who are feeling depression or feeling have gone through traumatic events feel like they lose control. And so this is by being able to be an active listener and hear what your child is saying or what the student in front of you is saying, I think gives them back that sense of control.
Do you think there's a way that parents wind up being judgmental in those conversations that they don't even realize they're doing it? Kate Nooner, you're nodding.
Well, I think we all naturally do that, and especially when it's your child who's, you know, your most precious thing that you love more than anything on earth, that you want to make it right, you want to solve the problem, you want to have that fix, when often that can feel invalidating and dismissive. And just like Kristen was saying, a lot of times just listening is what is needed. And, you know, something that parents do is they'll kind of have a sit down or something like that. That can feel very jarring to a child. And even for any of us, a lot of times when someone just is like directly asking us something, we're kind of caught off guard. But having opportunities with your teen that often get lost as they get older, but to interact by, you know what, take your teenage daughter to the mall, and it may be really boring, but walk around to all of her shops and, you know, do things like that, and similar things with your son to engage them. And conversations might evolve out of that.
You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 and 98.9 FM. It's a conversation about teens and mental health. After this segment, after this break, you'll have one more segment to get your comment or your question in. The number during this live Thursday show is 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. We're exploring the conversation launched by the Netflix series 13 Reasons Why, what the lessons are and what some perhaps dangerous myths about teen suicide are perpetuated by the series. With us today to answer your questions, Kate Nooner, PhD. She is an associate professor of psychology at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. Dr. Nooner is also a practicing clinical psychologist at the Chrysalis Center in Wilmington. And Kristen Williams is a licensed clinical social worker and school-based program director, school-based services. I keep flipping those words around. Program director for school-based services at Coastal Horizons.
I won't hold it against you.
Thank you. Coastal Horizons is in Wilmington. And you can call us on this Thursday with your own question at 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org. We've been over some of the warning signs for teen suicide. One of the issues that comes up is sexual assault, and I want to talk about whether that's happening more or whether we're just talking about it more. Kate Nooner, do we know about rates of sexual assault among teens?
In terms of rates of sexual assault among teens, they are, you know, higher than certainly they were 50 years ago. Something that's also happening more now than in the past is that teens are having more kind of parties when they're all together. You know, it's not traditional just going out on dates. It's kind of more groups who are oftentimes in situations or homes that are unfortunately unsupervised. And you can imagine how in a house there's a lot of different opportunities for unwanted sexual advances, for sexual assault, for rape to happen. And that was some of what happened in the series. And it's very, very common.
Is there anything that parents can do to protect, to do a better job of protecting their kids? I mean, certainly an unsupervised party with alcohol is a terrible mix, that and adolescence, terrible mix. But if I have a daughter, say, who is going to parties or is hanging out in groups like that, is there anything that I can do ahead of time to protect her? What kind of conversation do I need to be having with her? Kristen Williams.
I think the easiest way is to have those conversations about what are healthy relationships, what is healthy development, what sort of warning signs should they be seeing if they are in situations that they feel uncomfortable with, helping them develop a plan. I think putting kids in bubbles to protect them doesn't work. We need to let them experience activities with their peer groups, but at the same time making sure that they're well equipped to be able to access kind of resources, and then also know what things to look for and how to keep themselves safe when they're with their peers.
Kate Nooner.
And, you know, something that I work on with teens in treatment is kind of trying to help them cope ahead. That's a dialectic behavioral therapy technique where you kind of look for those forks in the road. You know, let's look where are the forks in the road, because oftentimes, and this is the tough thing with, you know, parenting a teen, a teen may say, oh, I'm going to the movies with this benign friend and then doing this benign activity, and they're lying. They're doing something else. Mm-hmm. And even your best checks, you know, you don't know what's happening. But, you know, so working with your own teen to where are those forks in the road? Where are those, things where you could be putting yourself at risk? And then also, you know, I've talked with parents about just having a completely open policy where you make it completely clear to your child that, you know, you can call me under any circumstances and I am there in 1 second for you, no matter what. I don't need any explanation.
Now, the flip side of that, I'm thinking about parents who say, well, there's got to be discipline. There have to be consequences. How do you do that? I mean, I can hear parents worrying out loud that they're giving their kids, they're just letting them completely off the leash then by doing that with no judgment or consequences. Kristen Williams?
I think the first part is that safety piece. So regardless of what their decision is, as parents, as professionals in the community, as people who work with teens, we want to make sure that they're safe, and giving them that opportunity to call and to reach out when they need help, I think, is the first step. And then we can have conversations of why did you make those certain decisions? Were they smart decisions? How can we maybe change our decision-making in the future? But I think by allowing teens to say, yes, come get me, I need help, I'm not where I should be, I'm in a bad place, and being able to allow them to do that in a safe way to maintain that safety for that child, I think, is that first step.
Kate Nooner.
And just to add one more thing, I think, you know, as parents, and this is something I talk about with parents a lot, because I think we think, well, let's just get tough on our kids. We need to think about the purpose of discipline. The purpose of discipline is to really teach your child how to make good choices, how to do the things that we want them to do. And with teens, things, you know, really change, and that discipline is not the most effective method of doing that anymore. Really working on your relationship is the best method. And so having that, you know, open door policy where your teen will come to you will then lead to conversations and actions where then they can be doing what you hope that they will do.
We're talking about the risk factors for teen suicide with Kate Nooner. She's an associate professor of psychology at UNCW and a practicing clinical psychologist at the Chrysalis Center in Wilmington. Kristen Williams is a licensed clinical social worker and school-based services program director for Coastal Horizons in Wilmington. You have a few minutes left to ask your own question on this Thursday at 910-343-1138 or coastline at whqr.org. Kim from Oak Island says she was a licensed clinical social worker in a different North Carolina county. Even though bullying is talked about in schools, she says bullying still plays a massive factor in the suicide cases. What approaches can we take to handle this problem besides the ones we're trying already? What policy changes do we need to make? We've talked a lot about parents and their relationship with their kids and engaging with their kids and making a safe space and remembering the purpose of discipline and being non-judgmental when the teen really needs to talk. But what about policy changes, structural changes?
I think one thing that we're doing at Coastal Horizons is increasing access for resources and care. And so by being on campuses and having a presence in the community and being places where teens are is also something that's happening in our community. So that way there's not this kind of, we talked about the stigma previously in the show, but there's this, these professionals are just kind of everywhere around us and they're just one other support. And I think when we increase access to care, that also helps.
Lenny from Leland says his son was diagnosed with borderline personality disorder and had some self-harm issues. He found out about those after bringing them into their home from an uncontrolled environment. I'm not sure what that means. How can parents respect their teen's independence and help them grow, but also parent them and maintain some boundaries before it leads to residential treatment? Kate Nooner.
I think in a situation like that, with a child who's self-harming and having multiple problems, it is very difficult. I think that, involving yourself in your child's treatment and getting your child involved in intensive treatment at an outpatient setting, for example, dialectic behavior therapy, the gold standard treatment for teens is to have individual sessions for the teens, family therapy, as well as a multifamily skills group where the entire family learns skills for tolerating distress and being more effective interpersonally and regulating emotions and what they call walking the middle path, which is, resolving teen and family dilemmas in ways that kind of benefit everyone. And so my recommendation would be to try to find a situation like that.
Ruth from Wilmington is a nurse. She says we need to learn to talk about suicide and depression as mental illness because it is an illness and there is treatment, that even adults have to deal with this too and need to use therapy as a way to learn coping and unlearn behaviors from childhood. Again, that gets back to this idea of stigma. Getting back to 13 Reasons Why, I want to talk just a little bit about the glamorization that happens in this series of Hannah Baker's ultimate suicide. There's been a lot of people have said this series has been a great launching pad for an important conversation. We don't talk about it enough. The conversation itself is stigmatized. The Washington Post wrote critically of it, saying Hannah's suicide tapes are a protracted example of the teenager who fantasizes about how everyone will react when she's gone. The story, he writes, strikes me as remarkably, even dangerously naive in its understanding of suicide, up to and including a gruesome penultimate scene of Hannah opening her wrists in a bathtub. Is that part of the danger of this series, Kristen Williams, that this character, although she commit suicide, she's very much alive throughout the series. She's the star of the series.
I think it is. And I do think it's a good launching pad for the conversation. So to go back to that point, I do think the fact that this series is there and it's causing us to have these conversations is really helpful. I also think there is lots of things in the series that I would say are certainly made for TV and, dare I say, entertainment, but that may not actually play out in the way that we see it in the teens that we're dealing with that are expressing suicidal thoughts. I also like to point out that another great reason to get kids connected to a mental health professional is that there's often a difference between suicidal thoughts and self-harming behaviors, and not all self-harming behaviors are suicidal attempts. And that goes back to that idea of depression being a mental health disease and a mental health illness that really kind of can dig deep and can manifest in different ways.
Kate Nooner, one of the issues here and some of the criticisms that I've just heard from people that I know who've seen it have said she's a brat because she is getting revenge on people, essentially. And what she doesn't seem to understand is that her revenge may be permanent, but so is the end of her life. I mean, is that part of the reason that teens sometimes carry out suicide? Because they're thinking, I'll show them. Is that part of it or not really? Is that a myth?
You know, Most of the patients that I see want to commit suicide because they're in a lot of pain,
yeah,
and they just want to not be here anymore. So I think, you know, and Kristen, you can chime in too. I do not see a lot of the revenge aspect. I see a lot of hopelessness. Mm-hmm. I would say that's the main thing that I see. And, you know, with 13 Reasons, you know, as a mental health professional, it's important to note that, you know, the quote-unquote counselor she went to in that story was an English teacher. He was not a trained mental health professional. And certainly if she had gone to a mental health professional, even though what she said was imperfect, what we say is always imperfect, and that would have been more than sufficient for a trained mental health professional to get her additional help. And to involve her parents immediately.
And for folks who haven't seen it, or even those who have, can you just kind of tell us the mistakes that that counselor, who was an English teacher, not a trained mental health professional, the mistakes that he made when she got up and walked out of the office? That was the point at which she decided, yeah, I'm going to do it.
Well, you know, first of all, it's always, you know, easy to critique. And there were a bunch. I would say the main mistake that he made was not involving her parents. She is a minor. And so she bringing her parents in is, you know, the most fundamental thing you can do and may very well have saved her life. The other thing I'll note is that as mental health professionals, we are not investigators. So if a minor comes to us and says that they were sexually assaulted, we just report it. You don't have to worry about making an investigation or getting a name.
And that was part of the problem. He said, well, was it really sexual assault, or did you just do something you regret? I mean, he really brought out the shame element.
Absolutely. And that would be something also as a mental health professional that you would take someone at their word and you would involve parents and, you know, then report as needed. You wouldn't worry about investigating as he was kind of trying to do, which was a mistake.
Yeah, and also pointed out to her that she was going to have to basically tell everyone and be willing to name the guy and testify against him.
Which is completely false. It's not necessarily true that any of that would be the case. It would just depend on what happened. And, you know, it was a mistake to mention that in that moment.
Now, let's just talk about, for those of us who are not mental health professionals, someone comes to us, a teenager comes to us, and whether they spell it out clearly or not, we are left with the impression they're considering suicide. How do we respond, Kristen Williams?
I think first, just being able to remain calm and present with that teen. And supervision is always important. So we never want, if we have concerns that someone is suicidal, we never want to leave them alone. So on top of connecting them to resources, I think just being able to be there and in that moment with them, I think is important. But then there's lots of resources that our community has and that we have as far as the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline that people can call. They also have the Crisis Text Line, which is a new option where people can text the word START to 741-741. And we find, going back to having the conversation of technology with our teens, that sometimes a text is a great opening for that conversation and for that door. And then we also have mobile crisis in our area and lots of mental health professionals to help.
And Kate Nooner, what would you say, just if you could leave people with one thought about what they need to remember when they're looking at teens and the risk for suicide? What can I do as a member of the community to mitigate that?
I think as a member of the community, you can certainly advocate for having more comprehensive health care, especially mental health care for, you know, children and teens. It would be wonderful if, just like we took our kids in for their annual pediatric check, that they went to a mental health professional and had a check, and advocating for that would be something important.
That's this edition of Coastline. Kristen Williams, Kate Nooner, thank you both so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If you missed part of this episode, look for it at whqr.org. Get the podcast. You can find it on the WHQR app. Tune in for the rebroadcast of this episode Sunday afternoon at 2. Join us for Coastline Live Wednesdays and Thursdays at noon here on HQR News 91.3 FM in Wilmington and 98.9 in Myrtle Beach. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.